Now, let's define idol for the benefit of our listeners. A false idol is not necessarily, then, a golden calf?
No. An obvious example of an idol, I-D-O-L, is the golden calf. In other words, a material object, often an animal. It can be a snake, it can be a cow, it can be a goat, which the devil makes you worship as God. But that's a very, or a totem pole, for instance, but that's a very clear and open kind of idolatry. But anything that people put in the number one spot in their lives that isn't God can be defined as an idol.
So it could be money, it could be pleasure, it could be or a golf game, anything that is an inordinate attachment then?
Anything that's taking the first place in people's hearts and minds, and to which they give the best of their, to which they most give honor and respect, that's in effect replacing God. Because I am a jealous God, says the Lord God, and I want no other gods before me. In other words, we've got to put God in the number one spot.
Isn't that really the whole history of the modern world, is because we become more and more fascinated with these various idols?
Well, I think it is, and it goes back at least to the 1600s, when modern science, quote-unquote, took off. If I say science, quote-unquote, it's because true science is going to say only the truth. But modern science, for instance, strongly suggests, the way people today use science, they use it strongly to suggest that only the material is real. And of course, that's totally false.
Now, I would like to discuss worldliness in relation to those of us that are traditional Catholics, because is there a danger, even for, let's say, the soul that's going to church on a regular basis and seemingly practicing his or her religion, to fall into kind of a mindset of worldliness more and more?
Yes, there is a great danger, especially if they read the newspapers and watch television, I would say, because especially if they allow their minds, if they feed their minds principally on newspapers and television, then there's a real danger, because through the media they will absorb all kinds of modern and basically anti-Catholic ideas and principles, maybe without even noticing it, and that's why it's so dangerous. And therefore, what the effect will be, to push religion more and more just into Sunday morning. I may go to Mass, I may receive the sacraments even, but unless the religion of Sunday morning extends its influence and has its rights throughout the rest of the week, again, I'm back to idolatry. God is occupying the number one spot only on Sunday morning, and that's, they've got Sunday Catholics, and that's very dangerous. And the modern world is more glitzy and more glamorous every day. It's getting more and more people to follow it. It's getting more and more normal. It's highly abnormal and it's highly unnatural. But each day it appears more normal and it appears more natural. And so the temptation to go with the flow is stronger each day. And the pressure is subtle and pernicious as well as open and blatant. And so Catholics face an increasing pressure to abandon their faith, or to let their faith go, or to diminish their faith, to dilute their faith, to not take their faith so seriously. There's an increasing pressure, and unless they watch out, watch and pray, said our Lord, unless they watch out, they could easily slide with the rest of mankind into this universal apostasy.
And does the devil sometimes work through distraction?
Very much. Let's occupy your minds with anything except with the things that matter. The sports are a special distraction. How many men spend how much time reading and thinking and dreaming about sports? Of course, sports are relatively healthy compared with a number of other activities, but they still act as an immense time consumer and money consumer. And at the end of the line, they, in themselves, they do very little for people's eternal salvation. Not nothing, because they can provide sane, at their best, they provide a sane and healthy recreation. But it should be only a recreation, whereas in fact, the sports heroes can, of course, turn into little idols.
Well, how is it, then, that many good men and women, many good Catholics, seem to slide into a mindset where they're putting much more effort into improving their golf game or improving their hairstyle than into their eternal salvation? How does this happen?
Well, usually it happens little by little. It also happens in everyday life. It's a little by little process. In other words, I pick up the newspaper each morning and I spend 5 minutes on the newspaper, then 5.5, and then 6, and then 6.5. I get more and more engrossed in the concerns and the way of thinking and the presentation of the newspaper. Similarly, television. I can allow my mind and heart to be virtually swallowed up by television because television is so engrossing. So there's a good deal of day by day. But what is also obviously very important is education. If a soul has never had a decent Catholic education, then it's starting at 10, so to speak, 10 on the scale. And if it loses 10, it's down to 0. But if a soul has had a good Catholic education, it starts at 50. And 50 will normally take longer to wear away than 10. So a good Catholic education is a prime way of learning how to stand up to the modern world. If I haven't had how to keep my faith and protect my faith, but if I haven't had that education, then I've got to give it to myself. I've got to read. And that's a very important point. Souls obviously must pray, and Catholic souls today must read. They'll never understand what's going on in the church unless they read. There's plenty of good literature by now about what's going on in the church and what's going on in the world, and plenty of good explanations. And if they read and keep on reading and pray and keep on praying, eventually, and pray for light, especially from the Mother of God, through the rosary, then they will begin to see. They'll begin to get the picture, and then they will see the whole ball game. Modern life is a whole ball game, and Catholic life is a whole ball game. The two ball games don't mix.
Now, most of the Catholic education system that existed, let's say, until Vatican II, has been dissolved for some time. So actually what you're talking about here is that most people today have not had good Catholic education.
Yes, that's right.
What books would you most strongly recommend?
There are many. It's difficult to recommend anyone in particular. Everything that Archbishop Lefebvre writes is usually very accessible, very true, and very balanced.
And very readable as well, surprisingly enough.
Yes. Yes, he's God's man for our times. There's not only the Archbishop. The Angelus Press puts out a lot of good books. Anything put out by the Angelus Press, some of them are difficult, but a lot of them are not too difficult. But a soul has, if the reading matter is difficult, a soul has got to make an effort. A soul has got to grapple with these problems. There's no quick fix for understanding what's going on in the church and the world, and there's no easy solution. There's no, I read two or three books and that's it. There's a whole steady effort that's got to be made over several weeks, several months, even several years, before a soul will grasp what's going on.
Now let's briefly talk about a point that's very, very basic. Why should Catholics place their primary emphasis on the salvation of their souls?
Because this life is short, 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 and eternity goes on forever and forever and forever.
I've heard many parents say, my children grew up, and that time went so fast.
Yes. Well, parents have a serious responsibility for their education of their children. Those years go by very fast because for parents they're often very happy years, and time goes quickly when you're having a good time. The parents are occupied with raising the children, but they must do everything they can to put the children on the right path, because what the children learn in those early years will be of immense importance for the rest of their lives. And what every one of us here, either parents or children, is here for, and what we're only here for, is to save ourselves and enjoy being with God for the rest of eternity.
How could it be that this short little life has such a great impact for all of eternity? It seems like another mystery of the faith.
If you stop and think about it, when we die, every one of us will have had sufficient time. This short life, however short it is, will nevertheless have given to each one of us sufficient time for us to make up our minds whether we want to spend eternity with God or without God. Either I want to spend my own eternity without God, or I want to spend God's eternity with God. That decision is such a serious decision that it takes time to make it. It takes a lifetime to make it. But on the other hand, a lifetime is enough. And the proof is that God takes some people out of this life at the age of 5, some out of the age of 15, some of the out of life at the age of 25, and so on. However briefly we live, if God allows that we die at 25 or 15, that will have been long enough for that soul to make up its mind.
So God gives us the time that we need
to make up our minds whether we want to spend our eternity with Him or not. Yes.
And that's a very big decision. So I think, like you said once before, this life is played for very high stakes.
Yes, that's right. Extremely high stakes. The whole of our eternity will depend upon this little life. And this little life, for that purpose, depends upon that last moment. It's how we die that matters. And all of our life is a preparation for how we die. And all our life is building, one way or the other, that decision with which we will die.
Is St. Alphonsus de Liguori's book, Preparation for Death, a good treatment of this subject?
It's a classic. It's a classic. So unfortunately, it's sort of 18th century examples, but it's, as to the content, it belongs to all time. Yes, it's a classic.
And what are some of the things we can do to make sure that we do keep our attention on our march towards our salvation and making that decision to stay with God and not get distracted?
Well, I've heard said a few times, prayer. The first thing is prayer. The second is maybe reading or the sacraments. Reading, if after starting to pray for somebody who's been away for a long time, for instance, reading in order to understand the necessity of the sacraments and the necessity of the Catholic Church. But if prayer reminds me of the necessity of the sacraments of the Catholic Church, then a return to the sacraments and perseverance with the sacraments and perseverance with reading. Perseverance with prayer, the sacraments, and reading.
Are retreats a good way of getting back on track after perhaps drifting into a worldly mindset?
An extremely good way of getting back on track. They were given, the retreats, especially of St. Ignatius, were given to us by the Lord God in the time of St. Ignatius of Loyola, which is the first half of the 16th century, exactly as a counterweight to Protestantism, is the antidote to Protestantism.
Were retreats originally intended just for priests?
No. Ignatius of Loyola gave retreats to priests or to laity. Of course, especially, he gave them especially to laity if they had a vocation. But no, they're definitely for laity as well as for priests. Priests have a special need to stay in touch with the things of God, but the laity may definitely need a retreat in order to stay on track. And some laity are aware that they need to make a good retreat, a solid retreat, once a year in order to stay on track.
But they were distilled down to 5 days, weren't they, for the laity?
Pere Valet, the Spanish priest of the early 1900s, the first half of the 20th century, he gave us, bequeathed to us, a five-day version of the exercises, which are, most men can find 5 days in their life. And if they can find those 5 days, then they get the essential of the exercises in 5 days, yes.
Is that's something that he kind of... there was a priest who bequeathed kind of the five-day retreat for the Society St. Pius X, was there not?
Yes, Père Barriol, who worked with Père Valet. Père Barriol is French from the south of France. Père Valet was Spanish, but Père Valet in the 1930s and early 1940s was working in France, and that's where Père Barriol got to know him. And Père Barriol had been a parish priest, and he was looking for a way of, as a parish priest, he was not satisfied with how he was able to get through to the people in Marseille, in the south of France. And he was looking for a way to get through to the people. And he found that the exercises of Père Valet were the way to do this. And so he moved into Père Valet's congregation. He spent at least 2 or 3 years by Père Valet's side in France. Then Father Valet had to flee to Spain to get away from the communists. And Father Barriol had learned the exercises by then. And then in the early 1970s, Archbishop Lefebvre invited Father Barriol to come and help out at the seminary. And that's where Father Barriol began teaching the exercises to seminarians. And that's the way in which the legacy of Father Valet was handed on to the society, and the society has been preaching the exercises all over the world ever since.
Now, it could be said that in modern times, in spite of what the Church teaches, in spite of what you say about the eternal destiny being so important, most people are actually in a fog as to their perception of reality and the eternal destiny. They seem to have lost sight of all that. Mm. And how do you think that has happened?
Well, it's happened little by little. It's happened with the build-up. The modern world has built up, we've been saying, has built up over many centuries, in fact. And the devil is working towards his masterpiece, which will be the Antichrist. And God is allowing it as a just punishment of the world that's falling away from him. But it's something that's been increasing for a long time, and that's why Vatican II is not basically a surprise. Vatican II was in a way inevitable. If men went on slipping away from God, it was simply a matter of time before the Catholic Churchmen also would slip away from God. And the process took a great jump forwards in the 1960s with Vatican II, and it's been going on ever since. But it's a day-by-day, week-by-week, month-by-month process over many centuries.
And you think that the mass media have played a big role in all of this?
Yes. The newspapers began arising the 18th century. They were, in effect, an instrument of liberalism. They've served as an instrument of liberalism. You were asking whether Catholic Church couldn't use television, and of course it can. Can't Catholic Church use newspapers? Yes, it can, but all of these modern media in themselves don't work for the Catholic Church. In themselves they work towards, I would say, they have something in their nature which inclines them to work for original sin rather than for the salvation of souls. And that's why I said that the media of our Lord are the pulpit and the confessional.
Now, do you think that television is among the worst of these technologies?
Some people say television is very bad, has very easily serves a great deal of, does, very easily does a great deal of harm to very many souls. But people who know both say that the internet can be even worse than television. I don't know exactly why they say that, but I think television has, when it comes to competition for how much harm they do to eternal salvation of souls, I think many people would say the internet has overtaken television.
Is that because there's so much filth on the internet?
It very possibly that's what they're thinking of. The filth is even more easily accessible and it's choosable, and there's an enormous variety. And he who sits on the internet is in control of what he wants to watch, and he can organize it how he likes, whereas the public programs on television are not under control. Videotapes, of course, are. But the internet, I think, makes that kind of sin, especially then, you know, the sins of watching impurity and listening to impurity, the internet makes that even easier than television, I think. But there may be more to it than that.
I think part of it could be is that, this is true of both medias, TV and internet, is that they can, and especially the internet, be very involving. And so
yes.
I've seen it happen where people just spend hours and hours and hours on the internet every day.
That's right. People get swallowed up in the internet. And it's more, people are more active. With television, you're purely passive. But with that's one of the accusations against television. With the internet, people are less purely passive. And that's one advantage for the internet. But at the same time, it makes the internet more engrossing. And people waste millions of years in, when you add up all the minutes and hours and that they spend on the television, it must be millions of years that people waste in time.
So these activities then are time wasters, TV and internet.
Besides the obvious attack upon morality and upon the senses and upon the purity of thinking, purity of thought, besides that, there is this tremendous wasting of time, yes.
But could a bit of discernment here be also in order? Because there are some good sites on the internet, and sometimes it's almost essential, let's say if one's looking for houses for sale, to use some websites.
Well, no doubt. Both television and the internet don't have to serve evil, and they can be made to serve good. For instance, still now, in 2005, a great deal of true information is available on the internet, which is not available in the newspapers and television. The newspapers and television are fully under control of the globalists, the enemies of God. Internet and television are not yet under... the internet is not yet under control. I don't know how long they will last. The bad guys, normally speaking, the bad guys will get control of the internet. At the moment, it seems very difficult. And therefore, at the moment, if you look for the right website, you can find a wealth of information which you can't find in the media, which you can't find in books.
So on the internet, then there's a mixture of good and bad, whereas on TV, it's almost all bad now, or at least useless.
Even on TV, there can still be some good things. Because Satan is not stupid and he's going to bait the hook with a nice juicy worm. But families should undoubtedly get the television set out of the home, period. Especially if there are young children. The television set must go.
In the last half hour of our interviewing, I would like to discuss the subject of families and raising children. Most parents deeply desire, in fact, it's probably their greatest desire of all, that they would be successful in passing their faith on to their children. Your Excellency, have you noticed any factors that help families to pass on their faith to their children?
I think, without any doubt, the most important is the personal example of the parents. And for the boys, in particular, the personal example of their father is decisive. If you want vocations, all you need is fathers who take their faith seriously. And automatically the boys will follow dad. They may not have vocations, but if you have a number of fathers who are serious about their religion, there's going to be vocations amongst the boys. The father and mother, by their personal example, how seriously they take their faith and how seriously they take their own personal salvation, that's for the children decide. That's for the children the most important. Because if they see that mum and dad go to Mass on Sunday but otherwise don't bother too much, they respect God, they love God, they honour God, but besides Sunday they don't give themselves too much trouble for the faith, the children may easily drift away later because they see that mum and dad don't take it that seriously. If they see their father and mother taking the faith dead seriously and the way they run the home and in everything, everyday life, that's what really serves the children, to keep the faith. I mean, Dad may have all kinds of faults, he may have this and the other, but if he puts himself out for the love of God, and if the boys especially see him doing that, that's what's going to enable the children to keep the faith.
And a very important factor in all that is that there be a family rosary.
That's another element. Yes, the family rosary is very important. I don't know why it's so important, but the Mother of God, whenever she appears, always asks for the rosary. And there's no question about it. The rosary is an extremely powerful prayer. And the rosary is the best protection of the home and the family.
And this should be said as a family then?
Definitely. And with Dad kneeling in front. So we're kneeling in, Dad leading. It's much better if Dad leads than if Mum leads. Because the natural leader of the family, as God has made him, as God has made the family, is the man and not the woman. And the man should not let the weight of leading the religion fall upon his wife. Because the mother is not the natural leader. She may be naturally the most pious, because women are naturally more pious than men. She may be the more pious, but she's still not the leader. And how many women would love their husbands to take the lead and to give the example? And alas, the husbands don't do it. And when the husbands don't do it, the mother may be as good and as pious as possible, but it's very difficult for her to lead her boys in particular, because the boys will look to their dad.
Now, there is a difficulty today in raising children and families in that the culture that surrounds us seems to be increasingly hostile to the Christian faith and becoming, as we had discussed earlier, more and more rotten.
Yes.
How should traditional families cope with that?
I think the answer has to be that if the children are fortified within, then the world can't do that too much harm from them from without. But if the children are not fortified within, then the world without is never going to carry them with it. So it comes back to the rosary. And the home has got to be both natural. Religion must be in the home, and religion must not be artificial. Religion needs to be natural to the home. That's to say, Mum and Dad must not make too fuss about Catholicism, but they must take it so for granted that it's in everything they do and say. And then, because if the religion is too artificial, the children will sooner or later throw it off. Unless the religion is natural. That's to say, unless the religion is really part of Mum and Dad, it comes back to Mum and Dad. But if the religion is, if saying the rosary is just completely natural, it's not an artificial and irksome duty, but it's like it's just a necessary part of the day, and everybody treats it as such, then the children will go with it. And if the children soak the rosary into their souls, the Mother of God can protect them against an awful lot of nonsense outside the home. So parents must turn the home into a sanctuary of natural, not artificial, but supernatural faith and hope and charity and love.
So what you're talking about then is the faith being a bit of an inoculation then?
Absolutely, yes. It's a tremendous protection. There's no doubt that the grace of God, there are many youngsters who go through the sewer of modern schools and come out smelling of roses, or perhaps not many. But it's very clear that God can protect, and the Mother of God can protect, if they wish. And there are some souls even outside the faith, some youngsters, even outside the faith, that go through these schools and come out smelling of roses. And it's obviously a protection of God. And therefore, what God protects, no man can harm. And what the Mother of God takes under her protection, Satan cannot harm. She has Satan under her feet. And so what you've got the love of the Mother of God and the perfume, if I may so say, of the Mother of God, and the holiness of the Mother of God, if that's in the youngsters' souls, through especially through the rosary and through the sacraments and through the Mass and through the example of Mum and Dad, the Mother of God, especially through Mother, if all of that is in the soul of the child, there's a limit to what Satan will be able to do. He will throw his worst at them, but they, if God, whom God protects, man cannot harm.
So the faith is number one. Nevertheless, as we were discussing about television before, there are some outside influences that one would want to protect one's children from.
I really think that television should not be in the home. If you want the home to be Catholic, you mustn't let the television in. Perhaps Mum and Dad can take the television back when the children are grown and gone. Perhaps, though even then. But it may seem a great sacrifice, it may seem impossible, it may seem difficult, it may seem this, that, or the other, but that television set's got to go. Also the other electronics. I don't think it's wise to give children Nintendo games, because they will draw children into this electronic world of little flashing screens, and from Nintendo games I'm sure they graduate to the internet and to television and the rest. And this electronic world is not the real world, it's a virtual world. And the children get used to virtual reality. They get used to living off virtual reality. And then they lose real reality. And if they lose real reality, how can they hold on to the real God?
One trend that has happened over the past generation or two is that electronics has taken over the mainstream children's culture. Let's say, I remember when I was growing up, the children of the small village where I lived would gather in the evening, and during the fall it would be a football game, in the winter it was a street hockey game, in the spring it was a soccer game. Mm-hmm. Today, in general, Game Boy and Nintendo and CDs and the other elements of the electronic culture seemingly has completely taken over.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. Because farm animals are reality. Playing a soccer game with other boys or even with other girls, I don't think soccer is the right thing for girls, but still, it's better than nothing, but still it's a man's game. The girls shouldn't get into men's sports if they can possibly avoid it. But the boys playing soccer is an excellent thing, with other boys, out with other boys, getting slugging and getting slugged by the boys. That's where boys need to be. And reality, that's real reality, even if it's only sports reality. It's still a lot more real than electronic games. The electronics, you know, CD, internet, Nintendo games, television, even videotapes. I mean, I think a videotape once a month in a family is a special evening, obviously a well-chosen videotape. That may be, especially in the big city, it may become necessary. All right. But generally, much better a card game or some table game. There are plenty of these games, a jigsaw puzzle, where the people are where the children are interacting with other children, with people. In other words, they'll become people instead of machines people. And still less electronics people. The kids lose their social skills the more totally they relate to the computer, the less they can relate to other people. That's an observation that the parents make to me, and it seems reasonable. These electronics are dazzling. They're glamorous. It's one magic lantern after another, which is more distracting than the last. It detaches from the real world, and the kids move into this virtual world where man is the master. I sit at my computer. I'm the master. I'm omnipotent and omniscient. I know everything thanks to the computer. I can do anything. I can order things anywhere. I can buy this. I can do that with the computer. But man is not omniscient or omnipotent. But with that, you know, children are liable to get the feeling that they are the master, that they can know everything, that they can do everything with this machine. And that's not a good thing for children to think, that they are the master, that they know everything, they can do anything. That's not a good, that's not, that's the opposite of an education for children. Children need to bump up against the realities, against the hard realities, and they need to learn the hard realities. They don't learn them with the computer.
Do you think that for a family to move to the country is a means of coming closer to reality?
I think in principle it can be encouraged, and where there's a will, there's a way. If a family knows clearly what they want from the country and knows clearly what they want to put in and what they want to get out for the sake of their children, and if they have a will, they'll find a way. But if they go out there with just a vague, dreamy idea that the country is better than the city, if they go out there dreaming, they're going to come back undreamed.
So it's a move that has to be well planned, and there also has to be a sense of realism about it too, that there are some sacrifices.
Yes, definitely. Cows don't take holidays, and if a whole lot of people have moved out of the country in the city, there's a reason for it. The city is a softer and easier way of life, and it's more suited to man's pride and to man's sensuality and to original sin, which is the only reason why so many people have left the country. But there's no doubt that in itself the country is a more healthy way of life. But you've got to realize that the cow doesn't take a holiday. You may not be able to take a holiday, because if Daisy is giving milk, then Daisy's going to have to be milked every day and you won't be able to get away.
Now,
that's just a little example of the various sacrifices. But those sacrifices which make country life hard are exactly the same things that make country life worthwhile and a good lesson and a good upbringing for the children. Scripture says, let the young man bear the yoke, bear the harness, bear the... In other words, come up against reality in his youth, and he won't depart from the straight way later. And the trouble with the modern city, and especially the computers, they make life very easy for the youngsters, and therefore the youngsters don't get an education in real life, and therefore they're unfitted for the rest of their days instead of being fitted.
Well, another thing that's happening is that many youth, surrounded by all these computers, are learning really only computer skills and none of the hand skills and practical skills that you have talked about.
It's much better if the boys and the girls are involved with their hands, either the girls sewing and stitching and knitting and using their hands and their minds on something real and which is not electronic and not an illusion and not a dream, but either wool or cotton or whatever it is. If the boys are handling machines, taking apart a bicycle, taking apart a car engine, taking apart a tractor, handling horses or animals, any of these things which are real are better than this world of electronics.
And I've noticed that, let's say, outside of these corporate elites that are running the world, that surprisingly enough, the men that are doing the best financially are skilled tradesmen. And many people who have good educations and are highly qualified are unemployed.
Yeah. That's a very interesting observation, but I'm not surprised. Today's universities are more or less useless. They cost a lot of money and they're useless. They don't train children for life. They're training them in degrees which are just unreal. And the children get used to being, their parents paying fabulous sums to keep them more or less idle and more or less corruptible and exposed to corruption for 3 or 4 years on end, learning some dummy subject from dummy professors. These universities are a disaster, especially for the girls. The girls don't belong in universities at any time. That's a very controversial statement, but I'm prepared to back it up. The girl's place is in the home. The girl's university is her home. And her great professor should be her mother. Let her learn how to make a home, how to look after a husband, how to look after children. That is her vocation and that is her happiness. And that doesn't mean to say that she needs to be stupid. It takes more than a stupid woman to raise and educate children, raise and form the hearts and minds of children. There are few people prepared to roll up their sleeves and do some hard, real work. And anybody in carpentering or plumbing or electricity who is prepared to roll up their sleeves and do hard work is much more in the world of reality. And I'm not surprised if they earn more money than the people in these artificial corporations with artificial structures and artificial CEOs and the whole thing is unreal. But
and these people are constantly subject, we're talking about the ones in corporations, to constant layoffs.
Well, yes, that's That's reality coming back. These corporations are living in these modern big corporations are living in an artificial and unreal world, and reality has a tremendous way of coming back, making its comeback. It takes its revenge, and if you separate yourself too far from reality, it will always come back.
Is one solution to the corruption in our civilization for a family to move to some isolated corner of the country and keep their children totally away from the outside world?
Yes and no. It works for a time, but depending upon what the children have learned in their home, if the children have learned in that separated home how to handle the rejoined universe, that's fine. But if in the separated home they don't learn how to handle anything except separation, then when they have to rejoin the rest of the world, they're going to be in trouble. And again, it depends upon what the children will have learned to want. Will the separation have taught the children to learn to want separation? And as Father was saying, Father Salson was saying a few moments ago, no man is an island and no family is an island. Man is a social animal. He's not just an individual or familial animal. He's a social animal, said Aristotle, which means that he belongs naturally to society. And that's why even a good family today is not enough on its own. And a Catholic family may be a very good Catholic family, but the children are still going to need to live in society. And if you haven't taught them how to live in society, within even a good family, then they're not going to survive in society. Therefore, a good family will teach them how to survive in society, and how to survive in society you don't learn necessarily by separating yourself from society.
Might part of the solution be that then traditional Catholic families provide mutual support to each other?
What's happening in the United States is that you've got at least two big centers like St. Mary's and Post Falls, Idaho, where a lot of Catholic families have gathered together. And that is a great help. But again, the whole question is whether it's natural or artificial. It's got to become natural. As long as it's artificial, then sooner or later it falls to pieces because nature takes its revenge and the children will abandon it and so on and so on. But if it has become natural, if it's a natural way of life, and the families are bonding naturally into a Catholic society, then the children can get a good deal more of what they need. And in St. Mary's, I think the children that have gone through St. Mary's, the schools, they are liable to come back. They go out in the big bad world and they get a taste of the world, and they realize that what they had in St. Mary's was much better. And I think a number of them, at least on visit, come back to St. Mary's.
And isn't St. Mary's producing a fair number of vocations?
It has produced in its years many vocations, yes, which is of course is a very good sign. That's a sure sign that the children are learning to love and honor God if they then wanted to give their lives to serve Him.
Then it leads us to another question. What does it mean to be in the world but not of the world?
Well, in the world it's an expression of our Lord. He's the apostle. He prayed in the 70th chapter of St. John. He prays to his Father that the apostles, he says, I'm not going to take you out of the world. The apostles are still going to be in the world. But he doesn't want them to be of the world, meaning they're going to be physically in the world, but they won't belong spiritually to the world. They won't be of the world in their spirit and in their souls and in their minds. In their spirits and souls and minds, they will be of God, but they will be out in the world in order to bring their fellow men, the apostles, to bring their fellow men to God. And, of course, that's similar for the children of Catholic families. They may later have to be in the world, but their family, if it's done its job, will so have given them their faith and hope and charity in the state of grace that they won't be of the world. They'll be marching, even if they're in the world, they'll be marching to a different drum from the rest of the world.
So in other words, there's a need to try to instill the spirit of detachment.
Yes. Detachment from the world, yes. Above all, attachment to God and to the things of God. Because if you want to detach yourself from the world, you've got to have a reason to do it. Because the world is attractive. The world does pull you to itself. So you've got to have a motive. It's not enough to say to the children, detach, be detached, be detached. They need something to be attached to. And if you fill them with God, then they'll be naturally attached to God and they will be naturally detached from the world. If you just say to them, detach yourselves from the world, unless they're attached to God, they won't have a reason to detach themselves from the world.
Would it help, do you think, then, to give your children that right spirit of attachment, let's say, to attend some of these events like ordinations and pilgrimages?
I think that's a great help. Yes, definitely. Because what it says to the children, if the parents take them, if mum and dad go themselves, then what it says to the children is that this is the what's important to mum and dad. The future priests, for instance, ordinations. A pilgrimage means the love and honor of God, the love and honor of these saints of God, of these holy men of God, or whatever. Going to pilgrimages and ordinations instead of to soccer games or football games or whatever it is, that's what's going to tell the children what really matters to mum and dad. And they will meet their other children, and it will be a world centered around the faith instead of a world centered around the world, centered around sports, centered around money, centered around entertainment. It's a world centered around God, and that's where the children will learn. And they will also be able to be social instead of just familial, and they will be able to make friends amongst children of their own age.
So in other words, it sets up, in a way, not only a web of friendships, which is so important, but maybe a counterculture.
A culture. It's restoring the true culture against the anti-culture which is surrounding us today. The true culture, which is the spin-off from Christian civilization, is being replaced by the New World Order's culture, which is godless and senseless and meaningless and immoral. But to visit these occasions, yes, is to help rebuild a whole atmosphere around a child in which everybody is centered on God. And that's very precious.
Now, our discussion up till this point has centered on parents, families, and children. Is there a role in this Catholic culture that we'd like to build for single people and for grandparents?
Oh, yes. Firstly, grandparents. The natural family is not the two-decker family. It's surely the three, even perhaps four-decker family. In other words, a family of three generations rather than just two. The two-generation family, mum, dad, and the kids, is not as normal as today it looks. And the two-decker family is well on the way to, coming down from the three-decker, two-decker family, you're on your way to the one-decker family. And what many children today are is one-decker children. That's to say, the children lean on one another, talk with one another, mix with one another, but the parents hardly figure. And that's the disintegration of the family. On the contrary, to move in the opposite direction is to restore not only the natural contact and interaction between parents and children, but also with grandparents as well. Because grandparents especially have a lot to give to grandchildren. The grandparents have got time. And the grandchildren have got a lot to give the grandparents. It's blood of their blood, flesh of their flesh, and bones of their bones. And the grandparents need the youngsters, the children, to put life and joy and light back into their old age, which is full of its miseries and illnesses and sadnesses. But the little grandchildren put the joy back. Ideally, and it's not easy, and it's no use dreaming about how easy it could be, it's not easy with our mentalities today, but ideally a grandpa or grandmom will live under the same roof as their children and grandchildren.
So nurturing the extended family is what is Catholic?
Surely yes. Again, you can't force things Catholic upon people with a thoroughly liberal mentality, because it won't work. You could try taking in grandpa and grandma, and then grandpa and grandma want to be independent, and you want to be independent. It won't work. The mentalities may be too far gone, but at least let me in my mind realize what is the ideal, so that I don't glorify the two-decker family, and so that I don't pretend that it's an excellent thing for grandpa and grandma to be pushed off into an old folks' home.
Or the children sent off into a daycare.
Exactly. Or the children sent off, exactly. The Catholic home needs to be rebuilt. The mother is the heart of the home, and if we had some mothers with that heart's wisdom and heart's love to be selfless and look after the two other generations, a lot of grandparents and a lot of grandchildren would be a lot happier.
Unfortunately, the school system is become anti-Christian and rotten. Do you think that homeschooling is the solution to this problem?
Homeschooling is the second best. The first best is a good school, because parents don't usually have the knowledge or the time or the patience, or they simply, if there's a large number of children, their physical ability to teach them all at the same time, or to look after little new ones that have just been born, and so on and so on. And there are some homeschooling mothers who are obviously absolutely heroic. So home, and added to which, the boys at a given age shouldn't be taught anymore. They need to be taught by men. So even the best of mothers is inadequate to teach boys beyond a certain age. But homeschooling is better than corruption. So you've got, it's a 1, 2, 3. Homeschooling is 2. It's better than corrupt and rotten schools. But number one, good schools are better than homeschooling.
So it's important for traditional Catholics to support good Catholic schools then?
Definitely. And let them trust the priests and sisters who run the schools. In the old days, if a boy came home and said that Sister Battleaxe had whopped him, then mum and dad whopped him a second time, and then they never again complained about sister. But today, alas, if little Johnny comes home and complains about his teachers, the parents get onto the teachers as though it's always their fault and never little Johnny's fault. But little Johnny's a little monkey and he has original sin, and that's what foolish parents today forget.
Is today's period of history perhaps similar to that period after the fall of the Roman Empire, when the world fell into corruption and disorder, and the traditional initiatives in our day, like building new chapels and schools and community, similar to the efforts of Saint Benedict and other monks to build islands of order in a world falling into disorder and corruption?
I'd say there's a certain comparison, yes. There's a certain similarity, because, as you say, the world is falling into disorder, and those who have the faith are needing to pick themselves up and gather together. On the other hand, there's a big difference between the fact that it's monks gathering themselves into a monastery, which is a very specialized and high-powered operation from a spiritual point of view, and ordinary families who are normally of low voltage, spiritually speaking. I say normally. Of course, there's great sanctity as possible inside families, but they haven't got the organization, and they haven't got the complete dedication, and they haven't got the motivation that monks have. So I don't know whether today families gathering themselves together can achieve what the monks achieved to create. The monks, in effect, virtually created Christendom. I don't know whether today's families can create Christendom, but they can do what they can do. They must do what they can do, and it will serve God's purposes. God will use the noble efforts of single families and joint families in order to continue Christendom. There's a certain comparison and a certain dissimilarity.
Well, then, perhaps then some of the solution is that the families have to work together with the good priests.
The families that wish to keep the faith will certainly need priests. Only very exceptionally will they be able to do without priests. Therefore, they've got to go where the priests are, or the priests have got to go where they are. And that's a little what we see in the United States with Post Falls and St. Mary's, Kansas.
And it's important that the laity support their priests and clergy, let's say, like the sisters.
Yes, it's very important, because if they take refuge with the priests and sisters and then undermine the priests and sisters, especially in front of the children, there's a strict limit to what the priests and sisters will be able to do. If the children see mum and dad criticizing the priest, the children will not think highly of the priest. It's the most normal thing in the world. If they see mum and dad, if they see the priests looking down on the sisters, or the sisters looking down on the priests again, that's not going to, the children will get the message, and they will think this is not where they should go. So it's necessary that there should be a considerable degree of cooperation, especially for a school between parents and priests, for the children to go the way they should go.
Is it important for laity to pray for their priests?
Absolutely, for sure. The laity will get, somebody has said, and I think it's true, the laity will get the priests of their prayers. In other words, the more and the more wisely and the more seriously the laity pray to have good priests, the more surely God will grant them good priests. But if the laity don't appreciate good priests, or if the laity mistreat the priests or unfairly and unnecessarily criticize the priests, they're going to lose them. They will lose them. The laity before Vatican II did not understand what the priests were really doing for them, and therefore the laity with Vatican II lost a lot of good priests. Gone. And a lot of good sisters. There used to be a convent school on the block, and now practically all of those convent schools are broken up and gone. Because the laity didn't really appreciate what was going on. Of course, the sisters were at fault too, and the priests, everybody was at fault. Nobody was, or few Catholics were really understanding their religion, and that's why Vatican II happened.
Thank you, Your Excellency, for participating in these interviews and for coming to Canada.
My pleasure.